Ever wonder about the impact you have on others or the impact that they have on you? The Ripple Effect on Thrive Life TV explores just that. You'll understand how one person, one moment can transform your entire life. Discover stories of profound influence, mentorship, and life-altering connections. Join us to uncover the power of human interactions in shaping careers, relationships, and personal growth. Subscribe to Thrive Life TV today with a 7-day no-risk free trial and start understanding the ripples you create and receive in the journey of life. Your story of impact is just one click away. Go to thrivelifetv.com or search for us in the Google and Apple Play stores. We'll see you inside. Get ready to believe that you can have it all. Time for yourself, the kids, your marriage, and your business. My name is Amy Wine. I am a Jesus-loving married mom, CEO, professional counselor, marriage therapist, peak performance business strategist, and believer in keeping it real. Real life, real relationships, real people. I help overwhelmed CEOs design a life they can't wait to wake up to each day. Each episode, I meet you right where you are with time-tested tools and strategies that you can find clarity on who you are and all the hats you wear and live your life authentically on purpose. This is real life, raw, sometimes ugly, other times wonderful and fun. And I cannot promise you that this work is easy. But I can tell you it is totally worth it. Are you ready? Let's get started. Oh, it's such a joy today because I am going to welcome my coach, because we all gotta have one, Michelle Cashat, to the couch today. And Michelle is an experienced communicator. She speaks internationally to a wide variety of audiences, and she has published 3 previous books, including Undone, I Am, and that book changed my life. Her 4th book, A Faith Will Not Fail, is published actually today is the day of the recording, March 28th, 2023. She is a 3-time head and neck cancer survivor and parent of children from hard places. Michelle is a reluctant expert of trauma, pain, and the deep human need for authentic connection and enduring faith. She and her husband, Troy, share a blended family of 6 children, including biological children, stepchildren, and foster-to-adopt children. They live on 8 acres outside of Denver, Colorado, and I get the blessing of her at least twice a month, usually more via Voxer app. Right now, let's go, and I'm going to introduce you to Michelle Cashat. Welcome, Michelle. I'm so excited to have you here. Like, you're like my favorite guest ever on couch.
Love that. I feel like I'm hanging out with a friend that we just happen to be inviting a bunch of people to listen into. But
I know.
I always love our conversations. We have great conversations.
I do. I mean, you're like one of the best people in my life. You're at my Jesus table. And I talk about that a lot because you're the one that gave me that. And I tell people all the time about the Jesus table. So they will know what I'm talking. I'm like, that originated with you. It was the best thing ever.
So I love that. It's so important to be cognizant of who we're inviting to sit at the intimate table with us, right?
Absolutely.
To actually make choices, not just do it by default, but we actually could be intentional about how being we invite to sit at that table. So I love it. I'm so glad it's helpful.
Oh, yeah, me too. So today is book release day for you. How do you feel?
Yes. I've been carrying around. Look at how nice we matched the book today. I mean, I didn't plan that.
I did not.
Nothing. This is my 4th book, but it never gets boring. It's such a thrill. It's such an honor. And this particular book, the life that I've been living while I've been writing and editing and releasing this book has not been easy. So I've literally been living the message of this book as it's been getting ready to be born. So I think that alone makes it a small miracle that we're here. And so I just want to acknowledge it's kind of a little bit of a miracle that we are literally here and this book actually has come to life.
I love hearing that. I don't love you had to go through that, but I love hearing it because, I mean, it's just going to make it so much more real. And I've read it with an advanced copy. And you know, one of your other books, I Am, changed my life. So every book you write, I'm like, oh, I have to read it because what's it going to change now? It's so good. So it's called A Faith Will Not Fail. And I love that it's laid out in bite-sized pieces.
Yes. So yeah, that was intentional.
Yeah. 10 different practices, 5 days per chapter. Like it's a devotional type, right?
Yeah,
like
it really is.
Easy. And that reminded me of your other book as well. So they should just buy both. However, they're not your typical spiritual practices that you hear of or the ones that we think of. So why did you choose these 10 spiritual practices? Because it was not at all what I expected it to be.
Which makes me happy. That's what I've been going for. A couple things. First of all, I did structure this book intentionally to be very accessible and digestible.
Okay.
The truth is when we're in hard seasons or we're wrestling with our faith or we're asking big questions, the last thing we need is somebody to hand us a textbook and say, hey, read this and then you'll be fine. Like we have no ability to do that. Because most of the time when we're in those hard seasons, we got nothing left.
Right.
Yeah, we're just like, God. So my thought was, how can I create a resource that's easy for people to grab onto? The worst thing in the world is to offer a lifeline that nobody can reach for. And so, you know, I wanted to make it accessible. So the 10 practices and 5 chapters per practice was intentional. Now, why did I choose the 10 practices? Well, I used 2 criteria to select the practices in this book. One, it had to have some kind of biblical basis, some kind of theology basis. So for those that are people of faith and that read the Bible, it had to have some kind of historical context that says, hey, this works. We suggest this in the Bible. So that was one criteria. But the other one was even more important to me at some level. And it was the fact that it had to be something I actually use.
I love that.
We may talk about different spiritual disciplines or practices or whatever. But that doesn't necessarily mean we actually use them and practice them. This had to be, and the practice had to be something that legitimately was something that I used and helped me. So if it wasn't something that brought some kind of help during the darkest seasons of my life, then it wasn't going to be included in the book. And so that's why we ended up with some that are kind of unconventional and yet very historically, biblically supported, right? I think we tend to, when we're in our church environments, faith environments, we always tell people, well, you know, if they're in a hard place, well, you should read your Bible more. You need to pray more. If you just, you know, would fast for 50 days and pray, everything would be fine. Now,
right.
I say that tongue in cheek, and there is certainly some validity and worth of praying and reading your Bible and fasting or whatever. I mean, I'm not dishing that. But at some level, it's become so familiar to us that we just disregard them. And so how can I really get more granular and practical in the very real practices that made a difference and gave me hope when I was wrestling with my thing?
Oh my gosh, I love that. Because I agree, like, oftentimes when we hear stuff, and I do this when I was at the counseling center too, is like, when you have to ask somebody to do something, have you been willing to do that yourself?
Yeah.
Or are you just reading that from a textbook somewhere? So, oh, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I tell people in a lot of different conversations about this book was not written in theory. It wasn't something that I just wrote that theoretically this would be nice. No, it was literally written in reality.
Gosh,
and so if it didn't show up in my real life, it didn't show up.
Yeah, because so many people are buried in life right now. We're exhausted, we're overwhelmed, sad. And the thought about adding, though, 10 practices to your daily life is like, I don't even think I could achieve that right now.
Yes.
So what do you say to those that have nothing left to give or who feel like this is just another invitation to do more work?
Yeah, that's a really important point, and I'm glad you asked that. I used the word 10 practices. I needed to come up with a plural noun for what these things are.
Uh-huh.
I called them practices because they sounded a little bit more digestible than disciplines.
Yes. I'm running.
But at the same time, practice. I used to be a piano teacher. I taught piano for years and years and years. And the worst thing for a student was to have to practice, right? We need that word. We don't want to do it. Well, I want to think about with these 10 practices, though, it's less about doing and more about being in what's already been done. So rather than doing more, it's about resting in the reality of the work that Jesus has already done and practicing that. So that's more of a, think in terms of like a spiritual practice, which is what this is, more like formative, spiritual formation driven, where we understand and recognize that God has already done the heavy lifting. It's not up to us to save ourselves. We can't.
but we try.
We try. I mean, really, and as you know, there's entire markets and therapy business that is making a killing because we keep trying to save ourselves and we can't. Side note, I'm a big fan of therapy, so that's not what I'm talking about. But at some level, we have to acknowledge that our condition is beyond our own ability to rescue ourselves. And so these practices are more about getting in touch with the work that God has already done and being present to it and practicing that in a state of being versus a state of doing. So for example, the practice of relinquishment. Relinquishment is just understanding that I do not have as much control over my life as I think and relinquishing, surrendering outcomes to the God who says he loves us and promises to be with us no matter what. So that requires less hard work and more letting go and trusting.
Wow. Yeah, relinquishing is hard for me. As you well know, as my coach, letting go of things is like, oh, no way me going to control that.
I'm right there with you. I tell people all the time, I am a world-class master ruminator. Mm-hmm. And rumination is simply a means to control. That's all it is. It's an attempt to try to control our circumstances by thinking them to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just sit there and ruminate. I might do that.
It's just like a very futile and foolish way to try to control. Of course, we don't accomplish anything with our rumination at 3 o'clock in the morning, but we do it.
Yes. Yeah. Mine spins and spins and spins.
Yep.
So one of the things in counseling that I do is I try to match it also with scripture because I truly believe that I'm here to walk alongside someone and meet them where they're at. And knowing I can teach you, I can guide you, I can listen to you, I can reframe your thoughts, but ultimately the end result's between you and God, right? Like between you and God. One of the questions that I got a lot, because I usually am getting people when they're at their worst or bad things have happened. And it's something I used to wrestle with too, is just from childhood trauma that if God is all real and good, then how does he allow so many bad things to happen?
It makes so sense to me why you would wrestle with that, especially doing the work that you do where you hear all kinds of stories of horrific circumstances, right? And, you know, even this week in the news, we've heard more horrific circumstances that have happened, and it's mind-blowing. Ultimately, in those moments, the reason we ask these questions of how can God do this is we need to have someone to blame. We need to somehow be able to point a finger at cause and effect. So that way, hopefully, we can not have to deal with that anymore. I mean, ultimately, we don't want to be in pain. And so blame and cause and effect is a means for us then to hopefully avoid pain. Unfortunately, however, this is one of those questions that we can wrestle it to death. We're not going to have clear answers. And part of the reason for that is, by nature, God is beyond figuring out. So I always love to challenge this idea that we want answers, because I've been there. I've done that before. Mm-hmm. I've had way too much suffering in my life, way too many losses and painful experiences. So I've asked the why question many, many times. But at some point during that, it occurred to me that if I actually got an answer, would that be enough? Like, is what I really want an answer? At some level, if I can understand the why behind everything that happened, then God that I believe in would suddenly become equal to me, right? He would become a God far too small. If I can unravel the magnitude and mystery of God, then all of a sudden this God that, you know, his magnitude and mystery is what makes him so awe-inspiring and worth worshiping, will become so manageable and so small that I would suddenly, honestly, not feel as safe anymore. Some of our security, this is hard, by the way. These are hard truths.
Yeah.
Some of our security lies in the reality that we can't figure God out.
Yeah, I'm processing that at the same time.
Oh, no.
It's like, wow.
It's hard.
Yeah.
But there is some truth to that, right?
Yeah.
We need to believe that God, you know, the Bible talks about his ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts. That terrifies us at one level because we're not in control.
Yeah.
But it also comforts us because why would we want any other kind of God? Right? So that's part of this whole wrestling with this question of how God can be a good and allow bad things to happen. The second part, the second consideration here is, we have to acknowledge that we are culpable for some of the evil and pain that we experience. For example, just yesterday, there was another mass shooting in the school
right.
in Nashville, Tennessee, at the time of this recording.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that at some level, humans have gone off the rails.
Yeah.
We are depraved. We have capability of great evil.
Mm-hmm.
That is a fact.
Yeah.
And some of what we deal with is just the result of depraved humanity. And that's, again, hard and doesn't necessarily make us feel any better, but that is a fact.
Right.
And then the final consideration that I wrestled through this question, and these are ways that I have made some measure of peace with the questions I don't have answered. The third consideration is simply that, what if my definition of what is good or bad, my definitions of those two things are not ultimate? What if I'm lacking information, that if I had all of the information, my definition of what is ultimately good and ultimately bad might be different?
Yeah. Yeah, so
for example,
absolutely.
Losing my speech, getting cancer of the tongue 3 times, losing my speech, my ability to talk and eat and all that kind of stuff was a worst case scenario for me. Like the worst thing that could happen after my first diagnosis was to have the cancer come back. That was like the thing I was most afraid of. And it didn't just come back once, but came out back twice. Mm-hmm. But then I paused for a second and go, okay, that was really bad. That was bad. That was a worst case scenario. But I look at my reality now. Here we are talking about a faith that will not fail, having a conversation about wrestling through faith.
Yeah.
And I realize that the beauty of this moment, this redemptive moment, didn't come in spite of my suffering, but as a direct result of it.
Wow.
So is my definition of what is good and bad ultimate? Or might there be some additional information that as a human being, I didn't have full access to, but in hindsight now, I can see how there has been some good that has been brought to pass as a result of my suffering, right? So, again, this doesn't take away the pain.
No.
It doesn't eliminate the grief or the loss, but it's kind of a reframing, which I think is what we need to do when we wrestle with this question of, can God be good and still allow bad things to happen? Well,
yeah.
Those three considerations, the magnitude and mystery of God that makes him beyond human unraveling, the reality of human depravity and our culpability for some suffering, not all suffering, but some. And then the fact of the matter that our definitions of good and bad are not ultimate, that there is information at times that we don't have because we are bound by time. And we can't see the full picture. And can we be open to the possibility that good could even come from our worst case scenario?
Yeah, I love that because, I mean, I feel like that in my life. And I say that to people sometimes and they're like, when they hear my childhood story of abuse and be like, how can you say that that was okay? I said, well, I never said it was okay. What happened to me was definitely not okay.
Yes.
But the result is that I have found God after years of not growing up with atheists, but I also now can sit and hold space for people's worst of the worst because it doesn't affect me. It affects me. I want to say this very carefully. It affects me because of on the human level and I hate it for people, but it doesn't scare me. It doesn't Like, there's some other people in the counseling that were younger and didn't have the same life experiences. And when they get somebody with severe trauma, like, it really, it rocks us all, but it rocks us on a different level. And I think because I lived it, I'm able to hold. Your story doesn't have to be mine, but the emotions and the hurt and the pain are the same. So
yes, exactly.
I know that's what God wanted me to do. I know my purpose of the outcome.
There's a verse in Isaiah that talks about she crouched in darkness, treasures hidden, and secret places. And that's so powerful. We forget that there truly are treasures in darkness. And that doesn't mean it's not dark. Like, you can hold them in tandem, right? You can say, this is dark and terrifying, and there's secrets here. There's something here that I can't get any other place. And what, yeah, you were talking, I was thinking, our family used to go camping all the time. And when we would camp in the woods, and this, we're talking tent camping, not glamping in the motorhome. We're talking.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. I will never do that, but I'm here for your story.
Exactly. But when it was the middle of the night and we needed to go to the bathroom and find the public restrooms, you know, that were down the pass and through the woods and all that kind of stuff. The person you wanted when you were a kid, the person you wanted to help take you to the bathroom in the middle of the night is a person you had walked in the dark before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get it.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't want the person that's never gone to the bathroom in the dark to lead you there, right?
Absolutely.
It's the person that's been in the dark, that's navigating themselves, that you want to be with you. And that, honestly, at many times, is the real miracle of our sufferings, is that the very things that we thought would destroy us and cut off any opportunity to connect with real life ends up being the means through which we are able to connect in relationships with others at a level we've never before experienced.
Oh, I love it. You just light up my life. So I do have another question for you, though. How do you come alongside someone whose faith is failing?
Yeah.
And how do we offer more help than harm? Like, what do we avoid as well?
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure you have some things to add to this conversation because you've probably, heard some of the fallout of that. Well, I can tell you what we typically do, which is not super healthy. Mm-hmm. When we are in a space with somebody who is wrestling with their faith or going through a hard time, therapying becomes uncomfortable for us. We are highly uncomfortable with other people's discomfort. And so our instinct is to try to fix it, to somehow either minimize it, devalue it, ignore it, or fix it. We don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want pain. And sometimes it's well-intentioned. We don't want the other person to suffer. So we say things like, oh, it's not that bad. You'll be okay. Or you'll feel better tomorrow. Or I'm sure it's not nearly as bad as what you're making it up to be. Or, and this is, I've had this happen, we say things like, well, you just need to read your Bible and pray more and you'll feel better.
Okay? So it's like,
right?
Yeah.
And in those moments, what we're really doing is addressing our own discomfort, not holding space with them.
Absolutely. It's kind of toxic positivity.
Yeah. I mean, we're uncomfortable with pain and the reality of suffering. And so we do things to try to relieve the pain, but really what a person needs in that place is someone to acknowledge the validity of their pain.
Yeah.
So when I was really wrestling with what I believed, and I've done this multiple times, I didn't need people to put scripture at me. I knew what the Bible said, okay? And I'm not saying that there's not times to quote scripture, but in those moments, I needed somebody to simply allow me to ask the question that I had and to say something like, it makes sense to me why you would ask that question based on what you've been.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Acknowledge it versus almost shaming you.
Yeah.
In the, well, because it's not that bad.
Yeah, exactly. When we do that, when we come back and don't allow the questions to be asked, whether we're doing it overtly or covertly, we're basically telling them something's wrong with you. I need you to fix it. Rather than, it makes sense to me that you would be wrestling with these really big questions because you've gone through big heartaches.
Yeah, I love that. So in the Bible, it talks about rejoicing. It talks about don't be anxious in anything. Oh my gosh, people say that to me, and I'm just like, okay, I'm anxious every day, all day, sometimes. But, you know, rejoice. And there was a time in my life where I didn't know what joy was. Somebody asked me, what brings you joy? I was like, I got nothing. So how do you reconcile that with this practice of lament, which you talk about in your book a lot? And is it possible to do both?
Yeah, exactly. Possible to do both? I think it's essential.
Okay.
I think lament, like grief and lament and joy, rejoicing, are two sides of the same coin. And if you try to strip one from the other, you have an incomplete coin. Okay.
Okay.
So, and let me explain. So, lament is simply giving voice to vocalizing the reality of grief. Okay. It's simply giving voice to a loss, some kind of grief or mourning or sadness, whenever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so lament is allowing yourself to acknowledge your desperate condition. For example, and having cancer and, you know, living with the kind of physical pain that I live with. And, you know, by the way, during a book launch, pain levels are like through the roof.
I bet you're talking all the time.
you know, to sit there and go, it's no big deal. I'm fine. Everything's great. That would be toxic positivity.
Right.
The reality is it really is hard to be in this body right now. It is very hard to be in this body. And every day right now, I am wrestling against my physical limitations and the reality of my pain, and lament.
Yeah.
That gives the truth. However, what a miracle that I'm able to show up here and talk about my faith in play.
Oh,
I mean, what a miracle that I can be doing this. What a joy that I can share my story, which actually redeems some of what's been lost that I'm lamenting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm holding these two things in tandem all the time right now. The reality of my suffering, and yet the glorious joy of my redemption and how God is redeeming these losses in ways that I could have never imagined in a million years. That, when they come together, is joy.
Uh-huh.
It's the combination of the two. And actually, they make it that much more profound. I mean, it's the suffering that makes the grief so extravagant. You know, it's the suffering that makes the joy that extravagant. The fact that, isn't this amazing that, for whatever reason, in spite of all these losses, that God's allowed me to be here at this moment in time and talk about his goodness here. And that's what we have to learn how to do, not just for ourselves, but to also allow others around us to do the same thing.
I love that you can have both. Because often when we're in the darkness and we're hurting, like, it almost seems like you can't have joy.
Yes.
You can't even have pockets of joy. People at funerals feel guilty when they're telling stories and people laugh. Like, yes. I've heard that. Like, I feel so much guilt. I don't know why I was laughing because that was a funny story.
Like, it was a funny story, and yet life was worth it. You ended up with a glorious life that we're celebrating, right? It is such an interesting thing. You know, lament is all about current reality, right? And obviously, if we don't believe in Jesus, we don't believe in eternities, and this is all we've got.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And maybe some momentary happiness if we do a Netflix binge one day or go out for ice cream, we have a momentary happiness. But current reality, like just human experience, is all we've got, right? But for those of us that believe in Jesus, we don't just have current reality, we have future promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotta hold on.
So even if God wasn't working this redemption in my life through ministry and writing this book or whatever, even if none of that was happening, I still have future promise. And the Bible says that someday when I meet Jesus face to face, he's going to take this very worn out body and he's going to make it brand new. So this body that hurts so much right now, someday God's going to look and say, enough, no more. And he's going to give me a brand new body and my taste is going to be returned and the pain is going to be gone. And I won't have trouble speaking or swallowing anymore. And let me tell you, I think I'm going to enjoy that first chocolate cake in heaven more than you, because I know what it's like to lose my taste, right?
Yeah.
Now, do you see how it's going to make my joy all the greater because of the loss? I mean, that's
so powerful.
It is. And it's a very interesting tension. And part of our progress in faith is learning to live in the tension of the two realities. Current reality, future promise.
So how do you cope with all the big emotions of this? Like when you're struggling with bait, like it seems overwhelming sometimes. So how do the practices that you have put in this book, how are they going to bring me really in my darkness and my struggles?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One, it's important for us to normalize emotions.
Yeah.
And big emotions, big feelings are the normal bodily response to difficult circumstances. I grew up in a very conservative faith tradition where it wasn't okay to be angry or sad or upset or frustrated or whatever. You just had to plaster on a happy smile all the time. That's not real. Look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. We're approaching Easter right now and think about Good Friday. And let me tell you, he had some big emotions. Mm-hmm. And he was contemplating his death and preparing for his death. These are big. So let's normalize emotions. Whatever loss you've gone through, whatever challenge you're going through, it's big enough. It's worth an emotional response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? It's normal. The second step or suggestion is we kind of deal with these things with big emotions. One, emotions are normal. Two, emotions don't mean a lack of faith.
Oh, yeah.
Emotions don't mean a lack of faith. Jesus wept, agonized to the point that his sweat was like drops of blood, okay? Mm-hmm. We're talking agony. Did he not have faith?
Yeah, he did.
He had more faith than all of us combined. He was the ultimate embodiment of faith in God. He knew God, right? Mm-hmm. He was God.
Yeah.
He had faith. But his human condition came with emotions that wasn't easy. So emotions don't mean a lack of faith. This is not only important for us. When we start to grieve and have questions and cry, we think, oh, I must not have enough faith. Not necessarily true.
Right.
Most of the time, not true. It's also important when we're helping our friends. When we see somebody that's really struggling with their relationship with God, you know, be kind, be gentle, be patient. Just because they're having some legitimate emotional responses to their circumstances doesn't mean their faith is dead. At times, what I've experienced is my big emotions mean that I'm actually, God is doing a good work in my faith at that moment in time. The wrestling is actually moving me closer to him. What's more scary is apathy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Where you're just like,
totally. So emotions are normal. Emotions don't mean a lack of faith. But also, emotions are a very important mile marker on the road to healing and a stronger faith. In other words, they're not a lack of faith. They're actually a productive means of building their faith.
Wow. Yeah, because you need him more in those moments that you're feeling
totally. My darkest seasons are the ones that now, at the time, they were awful and excruciating. Each of them. When I look back, I can see evidence of God's presence with me. And those are some of the sweetest times. In fact, there are moments where I say, I just want that again. I don't want the suffering, but I want that closeness and intimacy again.
Yeah.
We know this in our human relationships. Sometimes when we go through crises together, it bonds us together in ways that can't happen any other way. And when we're wrestling with our faith and we have these big emotions, rather than think that something's wrong with us or that our faith is lacking, see them as a very productive time that's actually building up the muscles of your faith in a way that doesn't happen any other time in your life.
So how does releasing those emotions and surrendering look different from giving up completely? Because to me, I'm a fighter. Like, I want to fight it out, but that's also control. Like, I just want to
control.
Right? Like, I got some control issues over here, completely aware. But sometimes I feel like just surrendering everything to God and saying, okay, this is yours. It's like almost I give up. I can't do it anymore. It's just yours.
You're bailing, right?
Yeah.
So how do we know the difference between surrender and basically walking away?
Mm-hmm.
And both are options, right?
Yeah.
And I have used this metaphor, which is helping me to understand that too. And I've wanted to know both options many, many times over. So picture you're going on a trip of a lifetime, right?
Okay.
You have this promised land destination, like it is your dream vacation that you're headed there. You're in the car, you're packed up, you're so excited, you can't wait to go, you get behind the steering wheel and you're taking off. But along the way, first of all, you hit and a construction in the road. You have to take a detour. And there's like a 10-car pileup and you can't get past. Yeah. Then for whatever reason, your transmission goes out. Then you run out of gas. You get in your wallet. Somebody stole all your cash at the last stop. I mean, you just have obstacle after obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. You know that there's a destination up ahead and you want to get there. And yet you just have struggle after struggle after struggle. You have a choice at that point. Okay? You can get out of the car and just quit. Mm-hmm. You can totally just park it on the side of the road, say, I'm done, and quit. Or, and this is, you know, forgive me for sounding a little cheesy, but this is the best way to do it. Or you can sit there and say, you know what? Jesus is the one that created that destination. He's in charge of the car, and he loves me. How about I let him be in the driver's seat, and I'll sit in the passenger seat and let him take me there?
Oh, my gosh, that's hard to do.
I think so. It really is. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. But what I want to point out is the difference between completely getting out of the car and walking away. Uh-huh. Basically, when we do that, we're giving up on the destination.
Yeah. You're taking me back to a trip to a Disney cruise we had once that sounded very similar to this, minus the losing, not having gas. And that, you know, 22-hour trip ended up being 72. And luckily,
and
we
you
left.
Just want to be done.
I just turn around and go home at some point. I give. But I get that. Like, I love that analogy because at the end of the day, I kept trying to tell myself during that trip at some point after my frustration and anger and bitterness and, you know, not so not kind words, I had to say, you know what? Maybe there's a reason that there was a 10-car pileup and we sat here for 2 hours. Maybe we were saved from something further.
Yep. And we have no idea.
None.
We can, you know, and this is, I'm a control freak. I'm be in recovery for that the rest of my life. I think tons of us that have very traumatic histories that kind of how we cope, right? That's how we survive. But in times of my life, I was more comfortable with Jesus in the passenger seat, me driving the car, and that didn't work so well. I kept running into obstacles. I had to make a choice. Either I'm leaving the car in Jesus or I need to let him drive.
Yeah.
Okay. And when I finally decided to let him drive, let me tell you, it's scary giving up control, but it's even more terrifying. I learned it was more terrifying to have the full responsibility of my entire life and every choice on my own.
It's really freeing.
Oh. It is. It is. We don't think it is in the moment. Yeah. But if you are in charge of your own life 100%, then that means everything wrong that happens, there's only one person you can blame. It all should turn to her.
Yeah.
Relinquishing control to a guy who says, nothing can separate you from my love. I am with you always. Never will I leave you or forsake you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Those are all things that Jesus said. Letting him be in charge and you hanging on to his coattail and say, I trust you, that's a pretty sweet place to be. And all of a sudden now, that ability to relinquish, as hard as it is, finally delivers the freedom and the peace that you've been wanting.
Yeah. And I think in my life, like, I'd always been searching for that, like seeking that. And it wasn't until, you'll know, like this year I sat there and did a 40-day new business fast and a 40-day new anything fast and did nothing but sit with Jesus. And there was times where, like, you even had to be like, nope, Amy, has it been 40 days? Oh, no, Amy. And actually, you know, a couple of months removed from that, it's like, oh, wow, that was really life changing. I am not operating from an under place of fear anymore. I feel released from so many things. The day.
I want something to think about. Something to come to you, Matt.
Yes. Come on.
I don't think you would have ended up with the outcomes and results you have right now if you wouldn't have relinquished control.
Absolutely not.
Because you would have never dreamed 4 or 5 months ago that you'd be doing what you're doing right now. It wasn't even in your imagination. In other words, if you would have stayed in control of your car, you would have not gotten yourself to the destination.
Yeah.
It absolutely requires you to let go for God to take you through this thing that you couldn't even imagine before.
Ever have imagined it. The day you said, how about if we extend it to Easter? And I was like, yeah, doing math. like, you lost your mind. But there was also a part of me that was like, I can do that. Like, that is so cool. And as Easter's starting to approach in another week or so, like, I'm feeling that energy come back that I didn't have after 40 days.
Yeah.
Like, I needed that extra time. And a lot of things, like you said, I would have never imagined the things that have happened. I have chills right now because of it. And now I'm like, all right, game on. And I actually purposely booked a girls' trip for the day after Easter so that I wouldn't just jump back in.
Yes.
So now it's like, okay, April 17th, game on. I am all in. I'm planning and I'm going.
And that was the beauty of surrender, of relinquishment, which is one of the practices in the book that, you know, it's, we hate it. We think we don't want it. And it actually ends up delivering better results.
All right. So for my final question, and this is one, you'll be probably going into coach mode because I don't think we've ever talked about this, but it was one of the things in the book. And when I got to it, I was like, oh, wait, I know I need it.
I need to make a note about
that. Yeah. And I still, like, it's been on my list of things to do all year, and I still haven't made myself do it. And last Sunday, I thought, oh, let's go to church. Let's try it again. And I still made an excuse. Mm-hmm. And I feel like so many people have lost, not just me, but faith in our church communities over the last several years. There's valid wounds. I know I have some valid wounds caused by leaders and members of the church. But yet that type of community is one of your 10 practices.
Yeah. So practice of community. Yeah.
I can make all kinds of excuses for why or not wanting to put myself in that hurt again, or it's just so much trouble to find a church. And so what do you got to say to, well, I'd say everyone else, not necessarily me.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's valid. I've had, and I will go into detail here, but I've been a part of so many very painful, dysfunctional, toxic church situations. So I get it. I mean, church is supposed to be a safe place. And when it's not, it's repulsive. Like, you know, like there's no part of you that wants to be there. When it comes to spirituality, that's like the most vulnerable part of us. So if we get wounded in that place, that's a problem. It's a huge problem. And certainly, some of the wounds that have happened in churches, it needs to be called out. It needs to be confronted. It needs to be addressed. This is not something we cover up and hide. It's not okay.
Yeah.
That said, and a counselor once told me this, so I'm going to give you a little counseling word right back at you, that what is wounded in relationship can only be healed. And not, I'm not saying the abusive relationship. I'm not saying that you have to go back to the abusive relationship. That's what I'm saying. But the mechanism that caused the wound can only be healed through a mechanism of health that heals it, right?
Okay.
No, we certainly have an option. We can totally self-protect and shut down church and not be a part of it. People do that all the time. That is an option. But then you're going to carry around this wound in your life. And I'll be healed.
That's the truth.
So are you comfortable with lugging that around the rest of your life? Or would you like some healing?
Not anymore, but I thought maybe avoiding it would heal that.
No, you just get to carry it. It just becomes a backpack that you carry around with you. And I think that's what we have to see it that way. We have to understand, like, we think we're protecting ourselves. All we're doing is lugging our wound around longer. It's just a backpack on our back that we continue to carry around because it hasn't been dealt with. And so what God wants to do, this is the beauty of the gospel. Oh, I'm going to get on my little...
You go.
So fast, I get so excited about this. The whole story of the gospel is a breach in relationship. Okay. So the garden, Garden of Eden was a deception, a breach in relationship, a breaking of boundaries, a huge breach of relationship. The rest of the Bible is God trying to heal his family through relationship. And what was God's mechanism of healing the broken relationship? Emmanuel, God with us.
Yeah.
But his wounded in relationship can only be healed. And if that is a model for the entire gospel, why do we think we can short circuit?
You're going to laugh at what God just did to me yesterday. I have taken up this practice of walking to the gym. I'm on day 6 today. And I know it's like a mile and a half up, mile and a half back, but then I go sit in the sauna.
Yeah.
But I have been wanting to cancel this gym membership for 3-4 years. Like, I don't want to go there. And it used to be because when I had the counseling center, like, I'd see everybody that was there and you could feel the uncomfortable tension when they see you. Oh, they know so much about me. What are they thinking? I'm like, I'm thinking nothing. I just want to get this workout on that I don't even want to do. Like, but I just didn't want to go up there because I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to go do my thing. Leave me alone. This is hard enough. All kinds of excuses. But now I'm like, I need to sit in a sauna because all the toxins and the allergies, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different story. So I thought, well, let me walk there and then walk home. So I've been doing this incognito for, well, until day 5 yesterday. And I come out of my sauna. And I mean, I'm going at like 6 o'clock in the morning. Like, nobody's going to see me because I am not wanting to be there. And I come back through the locker room to get my things. And somebody stops and she goes, is that you? And it was a woman that I have not seen in 10
years. Oh,
maybe longer. But we used to be in a Sunday school class, my husband and I, when our kids were little. Like, we did the children's church until my youngest one aged out of first grade. Like, we did my oldest. So for a decade, we're in children's church. Like, we're not doing our own. We're just children's church and we go to church. And then we joined a Sunday school class when they aged out and we decided to stop. And we loved it. But like, 2 years later, the church kind of built a new campus and everything split and it changed and people got mad and it just became this hill big thing.
Yeah.
So we kind of lost contact with those, that group of people. And it was one of the wives that was in all my Bible studies. That was one of the ones we were closest to that I have not had that friend group in years.
So maybe God's prompting the practice of community.
Yes. So I talk to her. We catch up. I find out she like watches my Facebook page. She's like, you're so encouraging. It just lifts me up. I'm like, oh, goodness. Like, you know, when somebody you know, you find out watches you online, it's like, oh, exposed. But she was so positive. And I kept hearing God say to me, ask her where she goes to church. I was like, this has been a topic in my house. Like, we've narrowed it down to a couple we're going to try. We just were like, well, maybe we'll watch it online first. So bad. And I'm like, I'm asking her that. So I go to walk off. I left the locker room. I heard it again. And I'm like, dang it. Turn right back around. And I say, hey, a little weird, but can I ask where you go to church now? And she goes, oh, yeah, absolutely. She's like, we're actually in a school right now. And she said, because I don't know, we were Methodist, so the Methodist church split. She's like, we're the United. I don't even know what happened there. I'll be honest. I don't even know. And I don't care about the denomination. So she's like, we're just meeting in this middle school. And she says, it's actually, we only have one service on Sundays. It's 10:30. Like, you should come and come with us. She goes, where are you going to church? And I says, well, we're kind of trying to find one. She goes, oh, I understand. Because I worked in that church. She goes, I understand. She goes, we got kind of a ruckus when we left. And I'm like, yeah, but I didn't want to talk about that. And she didn't either. And then I turned around. I was like, okay, well, thank you. I'll let Dawn know and maybe we'll show up. And she says, well, you know, a lot of the people from our old Sunday school class are there.
Oh, so your community is there.
Yeah. And she's, I have chills right now. Hello, God. And she started naming them. And I was like, oh. There's like 8 other couples that 20 years ago we used to do community with, just sitting right here, five minutes from our.
So perhaps this is a part of the when it's wounded in relationship, can only be healed in relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to have to think about that. And that's something you challenged me with last year was getting in relationship.
Yeah, I'm still in my notes. We can revisit.
I bet you do. All right. So I know we need to end, but I could talk to you all day, like literally. So tell everybody, where do they find your book? Because I'll post it on social and all the things and in the notes, but you tell me.
Well, as of now, it can be found anywhere books are sold. So you can get it at Target, at Target.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Parable Books, ChristianBook.com, basically anywhere books are sold. You can find links to most of those places on my website. So if you go to michellecoussat.com/faith, you will find easy links to all those different places where you can order it right away. I also recorded the audiobook of this book, me reading the pages of it. So if that's interesting to you, some people like to have me in their ear reading the book. My kids say, no way, Jose. Other people do like it. So you can listen to the audio, get the actual book or the Kindle version as well.
And that's such a God gift too for you. Because it's so hard for you to talk in the pain and to have to read the whole book and record
it. The whole thing. I actually redid the introduction twice. So yeah, it's like 7 hours of content. Again, I can't even believe I can do it. My doctors are constantly amazed.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Everybody go get it and just buy like 10 copies for your friends because you're going to need to.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. Alrighty, that wraps up today's episode of Couch Time with Amy Wine. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And while you're there, it would mean the world to me if you would take just a few seconds and leave me an honest rating and review. You can find all the links and information mentioned in this episode at www.amywine.com. Please share your episodes with your friends and don't forget to tag me on Instagram at amywineco. Thanks for listening and I will meet you here again next week. Are you feeling like your marriage is more about going through the routine than the romance? Just the day-to-day drudgery of all the things and the chaos that surround you that you have to do? You're not alone. Hi, I'm Amy Wine, your marriage and family therapist and founder of Thrive Life TV, and we get it. Impact-driven achievers like you deserve a marriage that is just as successful as your business. And your career. Your marriage is about more than just staying together. It's about growing together, laughing together, and reigniting the spark that makes you partners in every sense of the word. That is where Thrive Life TV steps in. Join me for exclusive sessions. We're gonna tackle real life marriage challenges. From reigniting passion to deepening your emotional connection. We're talking real change, real results. It is time to transform your marriage into a thriving partnership that you both deserve. On Thrive Life TV, you're gonna find practical strategies, shared experiences, and that extra push you need. Are you ready to uplevel your marriage? Visit thrivelifetv.com. And let's bring the joy and love and yes, the fun back in your marriage. I'll see you inside.